Hear these words from Psalm 72, 1 to 14. Give the king your justice, O God, and your righteousness to a king's son. May he judge your people with righteousness and your poor with justice. May the mountains yield prosperity for the people and the hills in righteousness. May he defend the cause of the poor of the people. Give deliverance to the needy and crush the oppressor. May he live while the sun endures, and as long as the moon throughout all generations. May he be like rain that falls on the mown grass, like showers that water the earth. In his days may righteousness flourish and peace abound until the moon is no more. May he have dominion from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. May his foes bow down before him and his enemies lick the dust. May the kings of Tarshish and of the isles render him tribute. May the kings of Sheba and Seba bring gifts. May all kings fall down before him. All nations give him service. For he delivers the needy when they call, the poor and those who have no helper. He has pity on the weak and the needy and saves the lives of the needy. From oppression and violence, he redeems their life, and precious is the blood, is their blood in his sight. And again, hear these words from Matthew 2, 1 to 12. In the time of King Herod, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem asking, "Where is the child who was born King of the Jews? For we observed his star as it was rising and have come to pay him homage." When King Herod heard this, he was frightened, and all Jerusalem with him. And calling together all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Messiah was to be born. They told him, "In Bethlehem of Judea. So for it has been written by the prophet, 'And you, Bethlehem, and the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For from you shall come a ruler who is to shepherd my people Israel.'" Then Herod secretly called for the wise men and learned from them the exact time when the star had appeared. Then he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, "Go and search diligently for the child. And when you have found him, bring me word so that I may also go and pay him homage." When they had heard the king, they set out, and there ahead of them went the star that they had seen at its rising, until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw that the star had stopped, they were overwhelmed with joy. On entering the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they knelt down and paid him homage. Then, opening their treasure chests, they offered him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they left their own country by another road.
So, as was said, we are now sliding towards the end of the Christmas season. Actually, it ends on Tuesday. It's the official church calendar ending. Tuesday will end the 12 days of the Christmas season. No more partridge in a pear tree. Take down the wreath, bundle the creche. Time to move on past Christmas. First off, I want to give a shout out to the preachers over the last four Sundays, to Pastor Connie and Jason and Dustin. The funny thing is, when you are the one that is assigned to come up with something to say each week, you seldom get a chance to listen in, and I got to experience that, to listen in for the inspiration that comes through others, for an image that may come and capture my imagination, and so I appreciated that opportunity last month, so much thanks. Also, a shout out to Chanyelle and Connie for rehearsing our children to help tell the Christmas story. Each year the pageant highlights a different angle. Each year we catch a different framing of the Jesus drama. And I think one of the things that makes the pageant so endearing is that things happen that I'm pretty sure the directors did not plan on happening. Like a real live growling lion. I did not know that a growling lion was present at the day that Jesus was born. Who knew? Or that a tiny little angel would be found eating cereal bits out of her yellow cup, totally at ease with her mourning as she roved at the manger, near the manger, somewhere in moderate proximity to the manger. And I had always thought that angels were adults. Who knew? Do angels have to grow up? Last Sunday, Dustin and a voice from the rear moved us through a sort of Mary and Joseph travelogue, paced us through several years of their travels with nothing more than a recurring dreams to keep them on high alert. But it was his comment about family that created a different kind of image for me, that Jesus had one, that Jesus would have intimate knowledge about family life. And he said, family is not all that different from yours and mine. Complete with our family challenges and dysfunctional habits, that likely Jesus didn't have a perfect one either. And for a split second, Dustin's family image took me backwards in time to the movie My Big Fat Greek Wedding, with all of its family characters, with an annoying uncle and a natty goofball aunt. And could Jesus' family have been like that one? Or did Jesus' family all have halos, as I had been thinking all along? It did get personal to me, I suppose, because my own family tree is pretty far from a perfect one. Comes with a fair dose of religious legalism, a couple of uncles going off their rails. When I look back down my family tree of ancestors, I can see where addictions have nicked my family. And when I look close, I can still see the pain of those troubles. But yet all this comes with great dashes of family good stuff, too. I have a spinster aunt who never married, but who adopted all of us cousins as if we were her own, showered us with birthday cards and kisses, and two of lives of in my family turning around damaged lives now in full recovery mode. So family, as Cedric has suggested, is a mixed bag. Mine does not come with halos. Not sure what you'd say about your family and halos, or how you might imagine Jesus sitting down to lunch with his extended family. So now this week, come Tuesday, we will enter into a new season of the year. Epiphany is what the church calls it. It is a time of unveiling, a Jesus presentation, if you will. Jesus has been born and is now presented to the world, and what will happen because of that? The scripture lessons during this season are chosen that have presenting Jesus in mind. There are four lessons that were assigned for today. We heard two of them. The other lesson is from Ephesians 3, where Paul is writing from prison. Prison. Not exactly a holy of holies place. Not a place you'd expect halos. And the lesson from Matthew 2, which we did hear, the city of Jerusalem has become a frightening place. It is anxious. It is nerve-wrackingly twitchy, for King Herod has gone from ambitious to paranoid, and when a king goes manic, there is good reason for everyone else in the city to be troubled. What's next? What will the crazy king do next? Everyone in the surrounding countryside is to be troubled. The king's palace is not exactly a holy of holies either. We have this in our Matthew lesson. And in the psalm reading, there are troubles, there are oppressive forces that need to be crushed. The plight of the poor that need to be looked after, delivery for those who have no helper, and dust licking for the enemies who do not see it that way. It is a psalm that is in our Bibles. It is a prayer for a leader to have integrity for the cause, because then, like now, the world was not always a place full of halos, not even close. But then there is the fourth scripture lesson from Isaiah that foresees a light coming into the world and a flock of camels bearing gold and frankincense pointing the way. Jesus is being staged to the world, and there are possibilities going forward. One of the delights of our Christmas week for me was going on walks with Isis, our granddaughter. I'm finding that she is quite smart for her age. Right now, she is trying to figure out her world, her introverted place in the world, what to do with her introverted self and her world. These days, she is asking different kinds of questions, exploratory questions. She says, Pop-Pop, what is a Methodist? Pop-Pop, when you retire and you no longer have a job, where will your money come from? She's trying to figure stuff out. But you know what is so delightful about talking with someone Isis's age is that they look forward. And already she has been wondering about her career, what she will do in her life. Isis, at her young age of 12, already knows that the world is not perfect. She has spent time in a therapist's office herself. She has been taking karate lessons to build character and confidence. Last year, she went on stage in her school as a green-haired Oompa Loompa and is thinking about a larger part this year. She has chores and responsibilities each day. She looks forward to spending Sundays with her youth group. But on her second walk of the week, she wondered aloud, what do pastors do? She thought perhaps in some way that a therapist had helped her navigate the world, that maybe she could do the same for others. Maybe I will be a counselor. And if pastors help people, she wondered if that might be a fit for her too. And I know she's 12. For sure, she'll change her mind 100 times before she gets to 21. But the coolest part of our walk is she was realizing she spends a great deal of time looking forward, and that if her imperfect self was fusing with a future that was hopeful. You all know it is a common practice for some when the calendars flip and when the ball drops in Times Square to gather up the old year and imagine what might unfold in a new year. New Year's resolutions, they are sometimes called, to imagine different thoughts, different actions, everything from faith to food. And it's often the following through on those thoughts that trips us up. Somehow the future looks better on paper. Traveling there can be a different story altogether. As you heard in our gospel reading this morning from Matthew 2, and for the illustrated story in front of you, is the story of the wise men, the magi. And it is a story with so much intrigue. There is a king going off his rails, and these wise men going up to his high palace but do not play his game. And is there a lesson in that for us? These magi then go deliver their gifts, but they go home on a different road. We read that these wise men were guided by a dream, and I never quite know what to do with that part. If Bible dreams are the same thing as the kind of things that we call dreams, because I'm not sure I'd make decisions off the dreams that I have. To wit, last week, I dreamt that Ray Miller was a dentist. And I went to his office, and he looked in my mouth and promptly sent me to a specialist up on Wayne Avenue. But I woke up before I could get to Wayne Avenue. Not sure if my dreams are for guidance or if they are for late-night comedy. I sent Ray an email asking if he might interpret my dream, and he said that I should inquire with Ginny before she is the family soothsayer. I did not know that either. So yeah, are dreams in the Bible the same kind of dreams that we have? Are dreams trying to tell us something? Maybe. There's so much to unpack in this ancient magi story. The gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh part, what's that all about? What are these gifts so far from the shelves of Target and the boxes of Amazon? These magi were from the east. Where in the east? An immovable star, was it moving smoothly or jerkily? Did it move quickly or slowly? Did it stop when they slept? Could they see it by day? Was it a day star too? And how do we wrap our scientific minds around any of it? And is scientific fact even the point of this? Then there is a king who is telling lies in an attempt to get his own way, a power play if there ever was one, and I don't know, does any of that sound familiar to you? Power plays do not end well in palaces, nor do they end well in family homes. And then there's the last line of the lesson, the Magi, the wise men, take a different road home. And whether it was a dream like the kind we have, or whether it was a special kind of God dream, or whether it was a strong intuition, they were wise enough to detour. And what if that was part of the gospel story, taking a different road? Pastor Connie and I have a dear friend who we've known for a very long time, and in 2019, she found that she was so tired and worn down. She has been for a very long time. Her marriage has been unraveling a minute at a time for 40 years, a deterioration trickle. Goodwill has slipped into spy cameras of paranoia over time, love into a twisted trail of verbal meaninglessness, and she's making a decision to move out, take a different road in favor of her life. Could a different road be gospel? Could it be good news? Well, we can easily see problems when they are more on the bombastic side. Herod comes off that way. He beats up and kills his rivals. Physical violence is a power play that we can see played out on a daily basis in a Texas church, in a Monsey synagogue, or in a retaliatory strike, or in the violent language hurled in the drama house in our neighborhood. We don't have to look very far to see this play out. But as Scott Peck has noted in his book, People of the Lie, evil can also be very subtle. It can be insidiously sneaky over a long period of time, creeping in until it drains you dry. And that's where our friend is at. No black eyes from violence, but sunken eyes from neglect. The wise men left by another road. Can another road be the gospel? Tina brought up in our Sunday school class the other week that as a veteran teacher, she notices some students leaving the faith behind once they leave school. Not all, for sure, but some. And wouldn't it be simply better to realize that Christian faith needs space to grow? And that dead ends, even in church, can occur. Wise men left by another road. Can we do the same when our faith needs to grow? Not abandoning faith, but reshaping faith, charting a different course. Last week, Cedric sent along a brief tweet to our church board. It comes from a church planter in Syracuse, New York, named Dan White Jr. His setting is urban and ours is not. But I thought I'd pass along three of the 5 points that he made, for apparently churches should not stay in one place either. Here is his wish list, 3 shifts for churches to consider making in 2020. 1, move from a CEO leadership model to a multi-voiced team. Two, move from worship on stages to meals around tables. 3, move from a listening crowd to a community dialoguing together. So maybe churches are permitted to take a different road too. Instead of tired Christmas music on my radio in the truck, I will often dig out Handel's Messiah this time of year and give it a listen. And I've noticed, especially this year, a most curious phrase in Overture number 12. Straight from Isaiah 9, for unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder. That's the King James Version phrase that is a showstopper. It is a road changer. It is a lane changer. The government shall be upon his shoulder, not ours, his. That is what's being said. The way that kings and queens go about their governance models is not exactly the same way that Jesus goes about it in his kingdom. This time of year is the season called Epiphany and is once again our chance to follow along in all of the scripture readings for this season to see exactly how it is that Jesus is presented to the world, where the divine order is governed by departments of righteousness and goodness and mercy and justice, departments of honesty with secretaries of compassion, where equality and neighborhood harmony and peace are not just campaign promises, but a divine ordering, all of it to the whole world. And if we were to find ourselves too far down the wrong road, or that our Christian faith was somehow dead-ended or co-opted, it is refreshing to read in Scripture that the wisest men in the world were not afraid to take a different road. And maybe that is gospel enough right now.